Radio Gorgeous presents Gorgeous Lives. Welcome to Gorgeous Lives. Charlotte Johnson Wool with Mary Killen on Gorgeous Lives. Charlotte is the mother of four exceptionally talented children, the most famous whom is Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. Charlotte has a much lower public profile than the children's father, Stanley Johnson, yet she is an artist of real stature. Those who have met her can exactly tell where Boris's charm has come from. Radio Gorgeous listeners are immensely privileged to be able to hear her voice and her life story as she gives a rare personal interview. However, a book which celebrates her immense artistic achievement is currently under preparation, and so we're fortunate enough to hear her discuss her art, her life, and her children. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about Mary Killen, the interviewer. Mary grew up in Northern Ireland. Her career began in Tatler. She's since written weekly columns for Times, The Daily Telegraph, and The Express. Mary's also written for Marie Claire and Harper's and Queen. She's presently The Spectator's weekly agony aunt and has a column in The Lady. Over to Mary and Charlotte on Gorgeous Lives.
Today I'm with Charlotte Johnson, although you have been known as Charlotte Vowell and Charlotte
Johnson Wall. Well, my second husband was Paul Wall.
Yeah.
And my paintings got painted originally as Charlotte Johnson.
I see.
So it's very mundane. I never know what I'm called, really.
But Charlotte is the mother of four extremely interesting people. Boris, of course, is the most famous of the four children. There's also Rachel, Joe and Leo, who is the undiscovered one, and in my view the most handsome, actually, the tall, dark and handsome one, which seems unlikely in the Johnsons. But she's also an extraordinary artist, and I think that perhaps, you know, you're about to achieve the recognition you deserve, Charlotte.
Who knows?
Tell us about your own childhood. We know that your children had a fascinating one, but tell us how yours started. You were the child of academics, weren't you?
I was born in Oxford. We lived in Parktown. And when I was four, we moved to London. And then suddenly, my father got called upon. He'd already read for the bar. And, as I say, with a fellow also, he got asked to go to New York and help set up the United Nations. So it was then at Lake Success where it was born. And we went to New York, and I had my first banana. I'd never seen a banana. And my first piece of chocolate, because I don't know why we didn't ever have any chocolate. But I suppose it was the war, and there just wasn't any. Anyway, it was very exciting.
And he must have been quite a young man at that stage.
Yes, he was. I can't work out how old he was. I suppose he was in his early 30s.
Yes.
He was in the war when I was born. I was born in 42.
Yes.
And he was in the Navy.
What siblings did you have?
I've got an older sister who's very clever.
What does she do?
She was one of the editors of The Tablet, a Catholic magazine. She was a nun for 12 years. And
were you Catholic yourself?
My mother converted when I was 8. So those of us who then existed, my two youngest sisters didn't exist, were baptised again. So I got 8 godparents, 4 from the first lot, from the first baptism, and 4 from the second, which was very good. Stood me in good stead.
And did you practice as a Catholic too?
Well, I got sent to 3 convents, the last two which I was expelled from.
No.
Yes. So sad, house, but such a good thing. My sister was head girl.
Mm. Which one was it, the convent?
It was called the Convent of the Holy Child Jesus, Mayfield, Sussex.
Yes. In the days when all schools were in Sussex, because the air was thought to be good for children, wasn't it?
Oh, really?
But what was your crime?
I was meant to be in French prep, and I slunk out of the front door of the building, pressed myself up against the wall, and looked at the boys on the village green. The road to Tunbridge Wells ran opposite the car park of the school, and I couldn't be seen, and I could see them, and I didn't know any boys, and I was absolutely fascinated by them.
Yeah.
Anyway, the French mistress in her Morris Minor station wagon pulled into the car park and in a very sinister way looked through me and went into the building. So the head nun said, would the girl, and she knows who she is, who was whistling at the boys on the village green, come to my room after lunch? And I didn't go, because I can't whistle.
Yeah.
And I went to her, and she said, why did you not come forward? And I said, because I can't whistle. She says, that settles it. I'm writing to your parents. And so I got removed.
But your parents were understanding.
They were so involved in having the baby to make their marriage work. They'd had rather an upheaval of a time between the two of them. And they had my youngest sister, Sophia. And she took up all their time. So, I mean, I could have been shot.
Mm.
And they would have...
And you were at what age? 16, something
just
like that?
Just 16.
So then you...
I went to Westminster Tutors.
Yeah.
I lived with the Fackners and with some people called the Pollens. And then I lived with the Richardson, Gordon and Peggy Richardson, with Sarah Richardson, Sarah Riddle. Do you know Sarah Riddle?
No, but was it Lord Longford, the Packenhams?
Yes.
Oh, that was quite a safe birth for a 16-year-old.
Well, it was very jolly. We lived in Cheney Gardens, and Rachel and I had been in the same pram.
Rachel Billington. Yes.
In Oxford as infants.
Mm.
Nanny used to push us round the park, and Frank used to walk across the park to go to Christchurch. And he never recognised his own baby.
This was in Oxford at the time. But so then you did well at Westminster, well enough to become an undergraduate yourself.
I did, by some strange chance. I managed to get into Lady Margaret Hall, where I read English.
And you did get your degree, didn't you?
I did, finally. I met Stanley. I was already engaged to somebody when I went up. And that all ended the first term.
Who was that lucky man?
He was called Winford Hicks. And he was extraordinarily beautiful to look at. Mm. But actually quite boring. He was a Trotskyite. And very much involved with the Union.
Mm.
And endlessly having meals in the Moti Mahal.
In Chelsea?
No, in Oxford.
Oh.
There was this place called the Moti Mahal. Where you saw chickens dead in buckets with eggs inside them, not come out yet.
How revolting.
It was so horrid.
He was swiftly toppled by Stanley.
Well, there was another man in between who was Stanley's best friend, so it wasn't very good.
Okay.
But I sat next to Stanley at the Encinia lunch, because I was invited because my father was a fellow, and Stanley had won the Newdigate Poetry Prize. So he was on my right, and Alice de Clare, who was a rather a hero at Oxford at the time, was on my left.
Who was Alistair Clare?
Alistair Clare was a very brilliant fellow of all souls, very young, wonderful poet, used to sing medieval songs to a lute. He was a philosopher, and he died young. He committed suicide.
Oh.
Very sad. He was rather beautiful, and there's sandwich between these two geniuses.
Mm.
I met Stanley. He wrote me a note, because in those days there was a system in Oxford where you could write notes, put them in a box, and a gentleman on a bicycle took them to the college that was on the letter. So he sent me a letter asking if he would come to tea. He came to tea. Then we went out for a walk, and as we were walking back down Norham Gardens towards LMH, he said, love is sweet, revenge is sweet afar, to the piazza, ha 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 ha. And it made me laugh so much that I completely started to go out with him.
Yeah.
And then he won a Harkness Fellowship as Professor of Poetry at the State University of Iowa at the Writers' Workshop, which was very good.
So he completed his degree.
He finished his degree, and I was in my second year. And he said, if you don't come with me to America, it's over. And I couldn't bear the idea of it being over. I gave up, and LMH were furious. And I went to America, and I had Boris in New York.
Yeah.
And then I wrote to LMH as we were coming back to London, to England, and asked if I could come back. And I was their first married undergraduate. And I used to leave Boris in his pram in Miss Mackenzie's garden. But nobody ever called me anything but Miss Fawcett. I was never called Mrs. Johnson. They never wanted to meet Stanley or anything. One nice old Don knitted an apricot-coloured cardigan for Boris. It was rather odd to choose that colour, I felt. But probably it was chosen very deliberately because it was neutral.
Yes. So Boris was a good baby?
He was a fantastically good baby. I used to do my essays and I would put him on the floor beside my chair. He couldn't walk yet. And I would give him something to look at or to do, a saucepan with some bricks or something and a lid. And he had a wonderful time. And then suddenly all noise would stop. And I'd look down and he'd be flat on his back asleep.
Oh, so you were allowed to finish your degree with Boris
as a baby.
So they
took me back. Mm. But, shock, horror, and we went to skiing in the Christmas back, leaving Boris with Nanny, who was looking after my younger sisters, who were much younger than I was. And I couldn't understand why I kept feeling sick wherever I went to the top of the mountain or when I skied down the mountain. And lo and behold, I went to the doctor when I got back to Oxford because I really couldn't understand why I felt so ill. And I was having Rachel.
Oh.
And they were furious. It meant doing schools 7.5 months pregnant with a child of one.
And another in the oven.
Exactly.
Mm.
And they said I was cocking a snoot, that was their expression, at them for letting me go back.
But you weren't, it just happened.
It just happened, as they always say. It was so funny. I went to my viva with Jonathan Wordsworth, who we were staying with. He'd been Stanley's tutor. And the tradition always was that the person... You went in clots of six, I think. There were those who were to be there between 9 and 11 or something, or 9 and 12. And the tradition had it that the person, they said, X at 9:30, Y at 10 o'clock, and would Z wait behind. And Z waiting behind was why you were for a first. I got asked to stay behind. It was quite clear, A, that I didn't get a first, and B, that they were terribly nervous by my being so pregnant. They wouldn't let me stand up to answer the questions, which everybody else did. And they couldn't wait to get rid of me. And I made some real howlers. I was completely out of it. I told them that Julius Caesar had been killed in battle. And then they said, we liked your metaphor. And I said, oh, good. So I said, which one?
Yeah.
And they said about Julius Caesar.
You passed your
I got degree. A second.
A second. In those days...
Which girls at LMH get when they read English.
Mm. Now, at this point, a bit like Desert Island Discs, we'll have a little bit of music, something that you like.
My favourite composer is Brahms.
Yeah.
I'm coming round. My father disliked Mozart because he said he could predict too easily where Mozart was going. I'm very fond of Mozart, but I'm not as fond as I used to be. But I'm getting fonder of Rachmaninoff, who is considered very vulgar.
Mm.
I'm not meant to like Rachmaninoff.
Radio Gorgeous presents Gorgeous Lives.
Having completed your degree, were you already interested in art by this stage?
I drew all my life.
Mm.
I was so much stupider than my brother, who was 4 years younger than I, and my sister, who was 2.5 years older. not to speak of the two sisters who were to follow, that I realised very early on, the only way I was going to get any attention was to draw, which I could do.
And they couldn't, or they didn't?
No, they just didn't. My parents, to do them credit, really encouraged me, which they didn't in any other way. I was regarded as a complete dodo.
Well, just by comparison to the genius siblings.
I used to hear my mother say, don't ask Charlotte to do it, she'll get it wrong. I did.
And did that make you feel small?
I felt small anyway. I felt very small, but I was Nanny's favourite. That was the best bit.
Yeah.
But what my parents did was to give me oil paints when I was five. So I was already doing oil paintings of people when I was five. But unfortunately, our house in Washington burnt down in my bedroom. A fire started and all my paintings got burnt.
Oh, no.
Yes.
We have evidence. You've got some photographic evidence, haven't you, of some of your previous works, which are being made into a book at the moment?
Yes, yes, I have.
As an oil painter, I mean, that is very difficult. Handling oil, did you have lessons at all at five?
No.
Self-taught?
Yeah.
Did you get people to pose for you and sit
for
you?
No, I made them up.
Really?
I did people like the judge of the dog show, who I'd never seen. And I did a lot of twins. I was very interested in twins.
Mm.
I did triplets. I didn't do anybody I knew.
When did you first start to sell your work?
I sold my first painting. It was 1967.
When you were 25? Yeah.
Yes, by which time I already had three children. I hadn't gone mad yet, but I was about to.
You had a fourth child, Joe, by the time you were...
29.
Amazing. But did you have a nanny yourself live in to help you?
Not until after Leo was born, the third child.
Rachel was quite a good little...
No.
She wasn't.
She wasn't. She was much more interested in climbing higher up a tree than Boris.
Oh, really?
And running faster.
So it wasn't relaxing looking after them.
It wasn't. They were wonderful. I adored them. I really loved them so much. I love small children.
Mm.
And I had a real sort of Montessori school. I taught them for a while. They didn't go to school.
Rachel said that you homeschooled them.
That's right.
Was that in America?
No, it was in London. Because Nanny could look after Leo. Though Leo came in for brief periods of the morning lessons when he had his own exercise books and things to make him feel that he belonged. And I taught them how to draw a squirrel and about different sorts of gases and all sorts of things. It was lovely. It was great fun.
They all have a thirst for knowledge.
Yes, I wonder why. Perhaps they weren't given enough.
It was a good thing that you didn't have to force them to learn, but they wanted to. Stanley has made much of the fact that he encouraged competition between them. Did you also say, Rachel, try to learn more than...
No.
No.
I didn't. That's very much Stanley's approach, which is very jolly.
Mm.
A lot of sort of clapping your hands and gather around me and now let's see who can win this. And I wasn't like that at all. Though there's always implied competitiveness when one praises one child more than another or congratulates somebody on a specially good drawing or something. It's very hard not to make them feel competitive with each other. But they loved each other. They fought like crazy.
Who would think that now? Because they seem to get on very well.
I know. It's lovely. It makes me very happy, that.
But Rachel did tell me that she changed Joe's nappy when he was little and that kind of thing. So she did have some motherly instincts. Rachel would have been about six when he was born, wouldn't
yes.
she? Yeah. Maybe she did.
Maybe she did. Maybe it's a sort of fantasy. I don't have any memory of it, to be honest.
But
that's not good of me not to remember. She may well have done it.
So you were bringing up the children alone because Stanley was abroad, wasn't he?
He was away all the time. And anyway, those were the days when husbands didn't do things in the kitchen or with babies. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I thought that was normal.
Yeah.
I thought that was what happened to one. One married, and then one had somebody's clothes one had to iron, and then one had a baby which one had to look after, and then one gave dinner parties for this man. I went out to dinner with him, and it never occurred to me. And then when I was having Leo, somebody lent me Betty Friedan, and I suddenly understood why all the women I knew were so angry, because Betty Friedan expressed it so well. And I never got that angry about it, actually. I painted at home, and so I wasn't constrained the way some women feel.
Frustrated professionally?
No.
But you were happy. You loved your little small children.
I adored the children.
And you were happy painting.
Yes.
But then you became unhappy, and then you may not wish to enlarge on that, but basically...
Well, things with Stanley were very difficult. I thought I was marrying a poet, and to some extent he still is a poet, but he went to the Institute of Agricultural Economics at Oxford while I was finishing my degree, as I went back to Oxford and finished my degree. He became very involved with the environment, which was all excellent, but it wasn't quite where I was interested.
Mm.
And he travelled a lot, and he enjoyed himself on his travels, put it like that. And I didn't have any idea about that, and then a dear friend told me. That sort of did it.
Yes. These friends, honestly, I wish they wouldn't interfere. But as it happened, you then...
Well, actually, before then, which was really quite sad, I'd become extremely phobic. And I was terrified, for example, that somebody would get food on me. And I was terrified of all forms of dirt. I couldn't bear a table to have crumbs on it, or anything, let alone dog shit on your shoe.
Mm.
That completely freaked me out. And it got so bad when Joe was something short of two that I got put in the Maudsley for 9 months. I had behavioural therapy and was the patient of Isenk. Hans Isenk, does that mean anything?
Yes. And were cured of the phobia?
No, I wasn't. I did 78 paintings, and they gave an exhibition of my work when I left, where I sold practically everything. And they didn't manage to cure me. Alas, I suppose I was better, but not really. I still wouldn't sort of go near anybody who is eating a hot dog with ketchup coming out of the end of it. I mean, it completely freaked me out. Anyway, so I went back to Brussels, where the family were now living. Stanley was working for the commission in Brussels, and it was wonderful to be with the children again, but I was still pretty ill. So I went to a place called the Clinique Saint-Joseph-Cortenberg, which was a loony bin in Louvain, near Louvain. They were much better. They got me much more cured. And then gradually, with a very good psychotherapist in Brussels, I got better. But it was terrible. I missed the children bitterly.
Of course.
It was terrible. They used to come to the Maudsley. Stanley would bring them over from Brussels, and I'd see them running down the passage to find me. And the awful thing was I'd have to say goodbye to them. And I did a painting from memory of them, which I got a copy of. They suffered a lot over that.
They did, but they've all seemed to have come through and be able to enjoy their lives, don't they?
I think so.
Rachel told me the other day that she's generally usually happy most days.
Yes.
Well, in those days, did you have electric shock treatment?
I had electric shock treatment, but later, when I was living in New York with Nick, my second husband, I got unbelievably depressed, and I was on dopamine for the first time for Parkinson's, and it did something to me. It made me unbelievably depressed, and I was given electric shock treatment there.
Which helped.
I mean, I didn't ever feel dramatically better.
But Charlotte...
I just forgot things. For example, I know I went to Alexander's wedding with Marina, but I have no memory of it, because it was just around the time when I was having electric shock treatment, and lots of people have memories of that time, which I haven't got. I mean, they never became them. They never went in.
Do you feel that this suffering that you underwent did actually bear fruit in the form of your art becoming better in some way, more sensitive? Or do you feel that what's made your art what it is a natural ability linked with lots of work?
I'm sure that what happens to one emotionally has effect on one's work, but I've never been able to track it down very easily.
Mm.
And there is a distinct purple phase in my painting, which is when I was in the Maudsley. I mean, the colours and the outlining in it is very distinctive. I can tell at once if it was done in the Maudsley.
So are you now interested in brain chemistry and that sort of thing? Looking back, do you feel that there would have been better treatment today, that you could have been resolved more quickly?
No, I don't think so. I think it's very difficult to deal with that sort of phobia and compulsion. Very difficult. I don't think drugs do it. And I don't think, well, the electric shock therapy was for depression, which is part of, funnily enough, precedes Parkinson's and goes with Parkinson's. Oh, joy unbounded. As does phobia and compulsion often precede the development of Parkinson's. So I see it very much as my whole sort of physiological self.
Mm.
It was a rather relief to realise that these things were commonly found in people who developed Parkinson's. I felt I wasn't quite as mad.
No.
It wasn't just sort of mad out of the blue.
Yes.
I had a reason for it.
More from Charlotte and Mary in conversation after this. Radio Gorgeous supports women. Women support Radio Gorgeous.
This is Mary Killen. I'd rather listen to Radio Gorgeous. At this stage, with your children growing up, you and Stanley had separated and then divorced. But weren't you living in Notting Hill with the four children?
Yes.
And at what stage did your second husband come into your life?
I met him at a dinner party in Brussels. And he came to see me the next day and looked at my work, met the children, and then rang me from Paris, where he was. Every 3 years he worked in Paris, he taught at Sciences Po, and he wanted to come up and see me again, and I said no, because Stanley and I thought were having an attempt to make our marriage work. But Stanley was having an affair.
Well, I mean, she's incredible to look at, isn't she?
Yes, and deeply incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, she was a great friend of mine. That
yeah.
One. I knew by this time about that affair, and he said it was over, and then one day we were dressing up to go out to dinner, and telephone rang, and I didn't realise initially, and Stanley said, "Where did you go into the studio and see if you can find that letter we were looking for?" So like an idiot I went into the studio, and then I suddenly picked up the telephone and heard him talking to him.
Oh, and you had a suitor who
so I
clearly loved you.
When he rang, I immediately told him he was most welcome.
But you were very happy with that second husband, weren't you?
I was.
What was his work?
He was a professor.
In America?
Yes, he had started out as a lad at the University of Wisconsin, then he'd gone to Harvard, then he'd gone to Princeton to teach at both places, and he'd become mysteriously Monsieur de Beret's driver in Paris when he was a student, and so he'd met de Gaulle and had marvellous letters and meeting recordings of de Gaulle and he himself, which alas, he never wrote the book he wanted to write about it. Anyway, then NYU asked him to set up an institute of French studies, which he did, and which was very successful. And he died then. He died very young. He was 67.
And how long had you been together with him for?
I'd been together with him. He died in 1996, and I'd met him in 1978.
Oh, well, that was quite good.
Yes, but we hadn't been able to be together because he was still married.
Oh, I see.
Of course. What do you expect? Chimes?
But at least you did know a proper love affair with loyalty.
Oh, yes. Mm-mm. Oh, very much. And then eventually, after he finally divorced his wife, we married. Married in 1988. In 89, I was formally diagnosed with Parkinson's, though I'd had it since 82.
So you've had Parkinson's quite some time, but
I've had it for 30 years.
And so does it wax and wane, or... It doesn't seem that bad.
Yeah. Except that I can't walk very well.
Yeah.
Which is terrible. and I fall.
Yeah.
But I had an operation in November, a brain operation, where they introduced two electrodes into my brain and linked them by a wire through my neck to a battery which is in my chest. And the battery is tuned up in such a way as to stop me moving all the time. So I don't shake or move all the time.
Or jerk.
No, which is a great relief because it was exhausting and embarrassing.
But your friend Marigold told me that you can now go to the theatre.
Yes, I can because I don't move all the time.
Yeah.
People used to say, would you keep still? And I couldn't.
Yeah. Is this a pioneering operation or will others be?
The guy who did my operation has done 250. I don't know whether that's pioneering. I think it's quite... I mean, people are queuing up to have it.
Yes.
Because it's... You survive it.
Yeah.
It's quite frightening.
And I got a blood clot
after it, which wasn't very good.
Mm.
But I survived.
Yes.
I have survived. And it's helped me enormously.
What is this surgeon called?
Dr. Joseph Zrinzo. He's from Malta.
Mm. He performed it in England.
Yes, at the National Hospital in Queen Square. I recommend it.
Well,
and him.
That would be very useful to some listeners.
He works with a doctor called Dr. Faltini and a doctor called Dr. Limousin, who comes from the University of Grenoble, which has a very fine medical department. And I think it was in Grenoble the initiative was for the operation. I think initially they were doing something completely different with it, as always. And they suddenly discovered that this thing they were doing to somebody who had Parkinson's was helped with their Parkinson's.
I recently gave a talk at a Parkinson's a charity, mind you.
Really?
Well, yes, it's a support group and they had a lecture and I spoke at it.
Which one was it?
I think it's just the Parkinson's Association, but they have these nice women. Candida Lysett Green's going to give a talk as well because John Betjeman also had Parkinson's. Mm. But so your second husband loved your art. That's one of the reasons why he fell for you, I expect, when he came and saw it. And how would you describe to the listeners? I mean, they're representational works, but stylish.
What I like doing is imagining I'm flying above cities.
Mm.
So I'm flying above that. I like looking down on things. The Paris ones, it's not so true.
Mm.
But I love the idea of the top of a building being bigger than the bottom.
Yeah.
I like the movement that it gives to a painting and to a picture.
When you do portraits, do you do them always from life or sometimes from imagination?
Imagination or life.
Mm.
Depends. I did that of Joe Reading,
mm.
the one behind the easel.
How long did he sit for?
He didn't really sit for that. I just did it from memory.
Mm.
I did the children up there from memory.
That's quite a well-known picture. I've seen that of Boris, Rachel and Leo as little blonde with almost like wigs, their hair. They're like beetle wigs or something, aren't they?
I used to cut their hair. I used to think I did rather a good job, but I now see.
No, they look nice. Now that the children are grown up, do you recognise the persona, the public personae that they have? Do you think that the public has them right, you know, in the way that, well, I suppose Rachel and Boris more so than the younger ones. Would you be able to say what their image is and does it contrast with the children as you know them?
Rachel is regarded as much tougher than she in fact is. She's very secretive, very private, and can be terribly easily hurt. And that's something I don't think anybody has the faintest idea about.
I had no idea.
No.
I had no idea she could be easily hurt.
Yes. She's quite sort of spunky.
Yes. And she's forgiving. I do admire the way she's forgiving.
Very forgiving.
Yeah. And when Ian Hislop of Private Eye had a column, I can't remember what it was called, Polyfiller.
Oh, yes.
Which was teasing Rachel. She was completely happy to have a laugh with Ian Hislop about it, wasn't
really?
She? Yes.
I don't remember that. I don't follow all that.
And Alexander or Boris, is he the bumbling figure that he appears to be?
Yes and no, but it has origins in... He didn't hear very well as a child and had a lot of ear operations. And when he couldn't hear something, he used to do this. I always could tell that he hadn't understood or heard something.
This is putting his hand at the back of his head. Yes.
Which he still does.
Yeah.
And it makes people think he's sort of nervous, which I suppose he is. He's much more easily hurt than Rachel.
Who would have thought that? You'd think with that amount of popularity, nothing could injure you.
No. No, he's rather soft-hearted.
You can tell that he's a passionate person if you ever hear Boris singing. I heard him spontaneously burst into song once in a private house, and with great passion in his voice, which, of course, he has a wonderful singing voice. He also paints. He's good, isn't
he? He's good at painting, yes.
Rachel has no artistic skill.
She has a wonderful sense of colour.
Yeah.
And always has had since she was tiny. She always picked up interesting crayons and juxtaposed them.
Mm. Your son Leo, who advises PricewaterhouseCooper, I believe, he has a daughter who's very good at art as well.
He does. She's brilliant.
Aged?
Ruby. She's just six. She may not even yet be six. But she did that picture of a man in dark glasses as a birthday card for me when she was five.
No. I love the one on the left. Is that by her as well?
No, that's by Lula, her older sister.
Oh, wonderful. As you say, when you do a painting, usually somebody snaps it up. Have you plans for an exhibition?
Well, Nell Butler is doing a catalogue of my work. And these two books of painting here are... One is a sample and one is sort of early version of one of the books that she wants to make or wants to make into one book. I don't know. She wants to do a retrospective.
Who is Nell Butler?
Nell Butler is a delightful and very clever woman who is a friend of Boris and Rachel's and Marina's. And
yes, and so that
she's
might be available
nice.
For sale then, the book.
Ultimately.
Because so many of the pictures were burnt in... What happened in the fire in Washington? How did that start?
Well, I was living with the Richardsons in Chelsea Square at that point. I got a letter from my parents saying, "Dear Charlotte, the house is burnt down," or words to that effect. What happened was, in my bedroom, it was the winter, an electric point got overused because a wire from it had led onto the porch room where one of my sisters slept, and it had overstressed the electricity. Fire set up in the wall, and at 4 a.m, my father smelt smoke, and the whole room was on fire. He got my sister out of the porch room, and Nanny and my two other sisters were on the top floor, and they only just got out. And Papa was badly burnt in his hands, and my mother got out. But it was pretty bad news. Lots of stuff got burnt, including all my things.
Oh.
And because Papa had been in hospital, and Sarah, my sister, nobody ever referred to it.
And because I suppose so relieved that they weren't killed. Yeah.
I'd written a book and illustrated it, which was burned, and all my paintings and all my clothes and everything. It was the most extraordinary thing to happen to one.
Yeah. Fortunately, you've continued to be prolific. So tell us about your day now.
My day now is much slower than my day has ever been. I've been used to being very fast, doing everything very quickly, and then settling down to paint or whatever. Now everything takes ages to do. I can't put my own socks on, which is infuriating. So getting up takes me about an hour and a quarter. Can you imagine that, the boredom of that?
Mm.
It is so boring.
Mm. This is because you're stiff.
I'm stiff and I can't bend, and if I try and bend, I fall over.
Oh.
It isn't worth it.
Mm.
So that's how I get up. Getting up takes ages. I have my breakfast brought to my room, which is lovely, and the paper. So I sit in a kind of trance while my pills go down. And then as soon as I think they're beginning to work, I head for the bathroom and have a shower. But it all takes an hour and a quarter at least.
These are Parkinson's management pills.
Well, I depend on them.
Yes.
I wouldn't be able to move. I take 7 pills at breakfast, 4 pills at lunch. At tea time, I take another 3, and I take about 5 at night.
But you don't have the depression that you once suffered from.
No, I'm not depressed.
Well, that's
good. I get very anxious about the children. I can't bear the publicity. It makes me very anxious. It really does frighten me. What? They're so ruthless, the press.
Yes.
You know, they say something which isn't true, and then if you react, they make more of it. Yeah. They make it into yet another story. And then if you react to that, they make another story.
I think that the public is beginning to be aware that that's what's going on, and they treat it with less... People do not believe as they used to.
Do you think that's true?
Yeah, definitely. I think people are becoming much more cynical. Unfortunately, this is why the young...
God, I wish you were right.
The young don't vote because they don't believe what they're told by the press. I think that's one of the things, as well as the fact that they're very kind of living in the moment and they don't think ahead. I can understand that. But also there's a brilliant piece by Boris, for example, yesterday in the Daily Telegraph about Syria, which was really one of the finest pieces that shows that his brain is magisterial, isn't it? And his overview is so useful. You can... He's not just popular for lovability and humour reasons. His brain works very well.
It does. And he's got a good sense of history.
Yes.
And he has a good memory for putting things together, linking the past with the present and so on, and linking different fields of politics with each other. He's very good at that. He's quite clever, old Al.
Yeah.
I never realised he was clever until he went to school. Where?
He was
an enfant doué.
Which is a gifted child. And so how old was he at the time that you learned he was gifted officially?
9.
Really?
Mm.
And then did that...
European school in Brussels called us to see them. And they said if we wanted him to go through the English school system, he should go over to England now because they wouldn't be able to give him that sort of education he could benefit from. So he went to Ashdown House, then Rachel went there, then Leo went there, then Jay went there.
And did it change his self-confidence once he learned he was gifted?
Didn't seem to notice it.
Yeah. I remember reading in the Andrew Jimson book that when he was a child and Rachel and the other said, let's play,
let's play reading.
Yeah.
Yes. Also, it's true to say that I used to say to them, stop reading and go in the garden. They used to all lie on their tummies reading.
That's wonderful.
I know, nowadays they don't do that.
No. No, children don't do it anymore. But we'll just have to see. I'm sure all will work out.
Well, as long as they don't stop making books.
No.
I couldn't bear it. What would we do with all our walls?
I know. But, Charlotte, apparently you're extremely popular. And
with whom?
With people, and you have quite a stream of visitors to your flat, which is... We're looking out now, it's in Notting Hill, looking out on lovely waving trees, with beautiful paintings in the room. It's a lovely, airy room full of plants. You have quite an active social life.
I do, yes. I'm very lucky. And I've got some wonderful friends who have stuck by me since I stopped being an amusing dinner party person.
Well, that's... I bet you are just saying that. You must be popular for a reason. And I would...
I love them all.
Yes.
I really do.
Your friends?
Yes.
Well, you have some very particularly nice ones. And you're on good terms with all your family, aren't you?
Even with Stanley?
Yes.
Yes, I'm on very good terms. Touch wood in all directions to the children.
Yeah.
I couldn't bear it not to be.
No.
I really couldn't bear it.
No.
I can get on fine with Stanley as long as we don't discuss either the past or the future or anything very serious to do with one's feelings.
Yes.
But he's very good to me, as is Jenny.
That's Stanley's second wife.
Yes.
Well, Charlotte, we're so grateful at Radio Gorgeous that you gave us the time. You're a little bit of a mystery figure, but everyone knows that you're a very important figure. So thank you for talking to Radio Gorgeous.
Well, thank you very much for bothering to come and wake me up.
Good. Goodbye, listeners.
Thank you very, very much, Charlotte and Mary. That was an exceptionally interesting interview. If you'd like to know more, come to radiogorgeous.com for photographs. This is a Radio Gorgeous production, copyright Radio Gorgeous 2013. Goodbye. Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.